Welcome to the Calder Farmstead.
Now the IceHogs back out to center in transition. Carlson with Quenneville 2-on-1. Right wing Carlson from the Quenneville scores.
Here to chance for Perrin.
Five scores! On the faceoff!
Up it's Emminger. Go back to Werenski. Has it. Shoots one. Bounces off a man. 5 seconds left. Werenski. Another jam on the shot. Turning and firing.
It's gone in overtime. The Bears breaking out. Right side with Bear. Looks like cutting to the net. Bear will score!
And here are your hosts, CeCe and Sean.
Hello and greetings from the Mile High City of Denver, Colorado.
And Voorhees, New Jersey.
Oh. Welcome to the Calder Farmstead Podcast, episode number 104 for Friday, June 3rd, 2022. If you were hoping for a podcast featuring tips and tricks for efficient sheep shearing, we are not going to be much help. This is an American Hockey League podcast, and my name is CeCe Hockley, the AHL editor of Full Press Hockey.
And I'm Sean O'Brien from StatsTrack and the AHL's only league-wide analytics guy.
And as always, we thank you all for tuning in with us.
And if you're new to hearing CeCe and I talk about hockey, we're going to do some playoff postmortems as well as preview the conference finals for you. We both watch a lot of AHL games, and we're going to talk about what we see when we watch the film, as well as use some advanced stats to help us break that down. If that's new to you, you may want to head over to our YouTube channel or our podcast feed, wherever you're listening to us from, and check out episode 0. It's a short primer on some of the stats we're going to be talking about, as well as how we view what's important on the ice. So if you're new to some of the more advanced hockey stats terms like PDO or the point shares model, or newer hockey terms like controlled zone entries, go check that out so you better be able to pick up what we're putting down. I promise it's not that nerdy or technical. It's only 20 minutes, and let's be honest, you wasted 20 minutes playing Mike Smith in game one. You'll never get that time back, so next time, why not spend a little more time with us talking hockey?
Now, are you talking Edmonton playing him in goal or the Avalanche playing against him?
Yes.
Well, fair enough. All right, well, let's get started. We don't want to leave him waiting in the green room too much longer, but... You know, he's an old friend of the show by now. You know, we probably spent a good 5 or 10 minutes talking with him before we hit the record button. That goes to tell you how much we've established a good rapport and just kind of a general sense of, a friendship. And so without further ado, the broadcaster of the Charlotte Checkers, TJ Shalott, bringing him back onto the program. TJ, looks like it's about dusk there in North Carolina.
It's pretty close, and I'm kind of hoping it doesn't start raining right in the middle of this podcast, but right now, it's a beautiful night here in Charlotte.
Yeah, I will give them credit. The Are You Afraid of the Dark reboot looks like it's going splendid.
I wish I had a match. I would light it and then just put it out.
There you
go. Man, I miss that show. Good stuff.
Cue the creepy music. Good stuff.
Well, unfortunately, we don't get to have too much fun on this segment with you, TJ. We are here for the postmortem for the Charlotte Checkers, unfortunately. CeCe, would you like to break down the game scores and recap and talk about the picks? So we will be sad.
Would I like to in present company? Probably not, but got to do what I got to do. Game one, Springfield shutting out the Checkers 6-0. Game two, Springfield eking out a win 4-3 against Charlotte. And game three, another bit of not a blowout, but definitely a convincing win to clinch the series. 5-1, Thunderbirds victory. They sweep the best of five series, 3-0. TJ, I will say for picks, I did choose the Springfield Thunderbirds. I did have a feeling Charlotte could eke by and take this, but I had a feeling the series was actually going to go to 5 games instead of Springfield sweeping things the way that they did.
I thought for sure that it would be, you know, maybe a 5-game series, maybe a 4-game series. I thought particularly after how well the team played in game two, that we would get one at home, coming home, getting that home cooking, whatever cliche you want to use there. But it was a packed house for game three. I mean, we had 7,500, almost 8,000 people in Charlotte ready to go cheering on the team. And, you know, that just wasn't in the cards. Springfield hot. I mean, they were just on a roll. They were a hot knife through butter. And I don't know that, you know, anything that the Checkers did really were going to stop them, and if you're Laval, good luck.
I at least was on your side, TJ. I picked Charlotte to win the series. I thought that them kind of being able to execute what I thought would be a similar game plan from Bridgeport, would transition very easily into Springfield. But yeah, and the model had Springfield as a 51% favorite. Me not usually picking against the thing that I program, but usually when I do so with good reasons for eye test things and conviction, and didn't work out that way. But let's dive into what happened here. And, you know, we had you on the last episode to kind of see what was going right and how the checkers could steer the ship in their direction. That obviously didn't play out for them. So without trying to literally just, you know, copy and paste our last episode into this one, what happened overall in the series for me, Charlotte was really sloppy in their execution in, I think, all three games. Game three in particular, first Springfield goal off a defensive zone turnover, just a missed breakout pass that doesn't quite get there. Springfield picks it up, rifles one home. Scoring chances, I felt like two. Charlotte had a lot of scoring chances that end up in shots that miss the net completely. It's all, you know, you're going to miss the net from time to time, even if you're a player at the highest professional level. Connor McDavid misses the net. Alex Ovechkin misses the net a lot, actually. But it is happened, but it did seem like every time that Charlotte got a good break, it was like 66% of the time they were, you know, not even putting the puck on target. another one for me too was it seemed like they just had a number of penalties that were the result of bad turnovers or guys getting caught flat-footed or out of position. And then it's, oh no, there's someone going the other way. Gotta, you know, give them the water ski treatment. And that got called. We also talked in the last episode a lot about that it seemed like Charlotte struggled to generate quality scoring chances when they did get turnovers, when good breaks happened to them. It felt like often were not able to turn that directly into offense. We talked about that on the last episode a bunch. They were losing the battle at the net front. We also talked about that in detail in the last episode. But going back to the penalties they took, giving up 16 power plays in three games against a power play you struggled to adjust to, also very far from ideal. We had special teams as the X factor in this series in our preview. Springfield went 5 for 16. Charlotte went 1 for 11. So in terms of preview accuracy, I feel like we got that one. Another big reason, I don't think this is spoiling anything, is Joey Decor did not play terribly well. Not the sole reason that they lost, but like we said when we were recapping the Laval and Rochester series, talking about Aaron Dell, as a goaltender in the playoffs, you are going to be judged unfairly when you let shots pass you that you clearly saw the release of. Dakota Joshua, Hugh McGing, and Alexandrov's goals from Game 3 come to mind. Are those high-danger chances? Yes, without question. Those are very high-danger chances. Are those high-danger chances that you need to stop as a goaltender in the playoffs? Also, yes. And a big credit to Joel Hofer. He played unbelievably well in this series, to the point where I don't think Chucky Seidberg's returning is really going to give them anything in Springfield, in the sense that, like, he's a better goaltender than Hofer. But given what Hofer did in his absence, I don't think Lindgren is going to give them another level of goaltending on top of that. I think he will be very fortunate just to put in an equivalent performance. But I think Lindgren's the better goalie without question, but I don't think he just gives them better goaltending than what Hofer did in this series, if that makes sense.
When I look back through, you know, those three games in terms of the execution, game number one, we know there was not a lot of great execution in that game whatsoever. Game number two, I think, was their best executed game, and it's the reason why they had the lead going late into that third period. But that final 3 minutes, 3.5 minutes, whatever it was, is really where the wheels fell off the wagon. Game three, however, was kind of like a perfect blend of both of them. I think at times there was perfect execution, and we saw it, but then they run into a hot goaltender, or they're in a situation like you just talked about. It's a Henry Bowlby chance that he just sails up and over the crossbar and checkers don't put that one on goal. Maybe that would have been the shot that kind of ruffled Hofer's feathers a little bit and allowed them to get back in the game. There was also times in game number three where I don't think they played a very smart hockey IQ type game. I think back, you know, the checkers give up that first goal. It was off a Dennis Chalowski turnover in the corner. And okay, you give up the first goal, but you're still at home. Your crowd's still in it. It was still an electric atmosphere, even though you're down a goal. Then you get a power play. The power play lasted all of 11 seconds before the checkers commit a penalty of their own. That's not going to help. You know, that kind of stuff isn't going to work. And when you talk about the amount of penalties that the checkers took in this series, they were a team that committed a number of penalties throughout the regular season as well. So I didn't really expect them to suddenly become this very disciplined team in the postseason. I just expected the veteran leadership to kind of curtail some of the younger guys a little bit so that they didn't get hemmed into situations. You know, sometimes you have to take a penalty, and with how hard Springfield was playing, there were a number of those 16 penalties were just calls that the checkers had to absolutely take, because if it wasn't, it was going to be a breakaway the other way and almost a guaranteed goal. And you know, you're still going to take the risk of going up against a very hot Springfield power play than giving them a free shot. But at the end of the day, in that game three, I can think of a situation where Luke Henman drew a penalty. It was perfect. He got an interference call. Excuse me. It was Henry Bowlby coming into the zone, drew the interference call, and Luke Henman was his line mate that then went after, it was Tommy Cross.
I think it was either Cross or Santini. I don't remember exactly, but I remember the play you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, Henman trying to stick up for his buddy. I know of no coach on the planet that would be, you know, upset that a player is trying to stick up for his teammate in that situation. But ultimately it ended up with matching minors. So the checkers would have had a power play after they only had 11 seconds last time. They're already down 1-0. This is a golden opportunity to get a goal, get the crowd back on your feet. And now you're going to 4-on-4, which I think the checkers still have an advantage 4-on-4. They're just a little bit faster than Springfield, but it wasn't in the cards. So I think when you look at all three games on the whole, game one, not great. Game two was a backbreaker the way it ended, and that kind of momentum just being handed to Springfield after they earned that win in game two, that's really tough to come back from. But I expected the checkers to come out strong on game three, and you know, they did come out with a little bit of fire, but that first goal was a backbreaker, and then some of the mistakes along the way, you know, they just kind of got in their own way. And at the same time, they're running into an unstoppable force in Springfield who, even if you are the immovable wall, I don't know who wins that.
Yeah, I mean, especially for me too, watching some of the saves that Joel Hofer made, where it's just like, there were a couple of times where I would see the chance coming, knowing that they lost the game and didn't, you know, score a lot of goals. And it's like, wait, is this the goal? And I'm like hitting pause and checking the score sheet, like, wait, no. And he somehow gets across and makes a save, or Charlotte misses the net or hits the post or something like that. And it was just so many of those moments where it's like, if, you know, I don't know how many people out there are familiar with the Money Puck Deserve to Win-O-Meter. Very fun tool that I feel like it's underutilized by hockey fans. But like, if we were to look at an AHL version of that for some of those games that Charlotte played, I feel like at least game three was the one where they probably deserved to win, or at least deserved to have that look like a closer outcome than what it did. Because I felt like Joel Hofer made a number of just absolutely ridiculous saves that he, I mean, based on what I saw from him in the regular season, had no business making, and yet somehow here we are.
Yeah, and the checkers game plan, we talked about this last show. I thought game plan in game number two, which was almost the same game plan in game number three, almost to a T, and why wouldn't it be? You came so close in game two, you probably should have won game two. There's not really a need to change too much there, and they didn't really change too much lineup-wise or with the game plan, and I thought that was the right game plan. I thought that head coach Jordy Kinnear and assistant coach Dan Bylsma, the X's and O's were drawn up properly. You know, it's not that they were out there playing the wrong style against Springfield and that's the reason why they got mopped up. I think it was just on the execution side of things, particularly in the end of that game two, and really just kind of in ebbs and flows in game three. They knew what their game plan was, and whether it was how hard Springfield was playing or just the momentum they had, whatever it was, something was throwing them off their game and throwing them off their execution. They weren't able to get it done.
Yeah, it really was. I think it comes down to a lot of execution. I mean, a lot of passes and skates, or guys like trying to do the one hand stretch when it needed to be on their tape in moments. And that definitely seemed like it made a lot of small differences in plays. You know, if you have to take a second to catch a pass that if it was on your tape, you get to, you know, take two strides and go right away, or you can catch in stride versus, you know, you got a stretcher reach behind you or you miss the pass completely. Like, That changes maybe one zone entry or one rush, but like it seemed like that was a lot of small instances that added up over the series for Charlotte that didn't seem to happen as much for Springfield. They were the sharper team, I think, overall in the series, and that hurt. And you know, it's it's tough. So let's transition here to the big kind of question we've been asking. For you, would you call this Charlotte season in sum, beginning to end October to June, a success, a failure, or somewhere in between?
I would absolutely call it a success for a number of reasons. Number one, you're talking about the dual affiliation. I mean, that in itself, dealing with Seattle and Florida's AHL affiliate, you have assistant coach Dan Bylsma being appointed by Seattle. All of those working gears that we've talked about all season long, that in itself is certainly a success. I mean, not only to make the playoffs, but to win the division over Springfield by tiebreaker, but still, we're going to hang the banner next year as the Atlantic Division champs. I think that is huge. I mean, because the other side of that is this is a new affiliation on the Florida side. So it's not like if we had stuck around with the Carolina Hurricanes and were absorbing just a handful of players from Seattle. All of these guys are new to the Charlotte area, to understanding just the way of life, the arena, all that stuff. And I mean, I know you kind of get that out of the way in the first couple months once you fall into a rhythm and things like that. And we saw that if you just look back at their records, you can see when the team really started to gel together in that November, December timeframe, and then again in March. But I absolutely think it's a success. I mean, when you talk about the number of players that were up in the NHL for both organizations, it's just, it was certainly a success. You win the division, you make it to the third round of the playoffs. Granted, the first round was a bye, but still, you made it to the third round of the playoffs with two different affiliates, with head coach from one organization, assistant coach from another organization, goaltenders from both organizations. I mean, you have Decord from Seattle, Gibson from Florida, Bebo was in there, all those ECHL guys coming in. It certainly was a success in my eyes.
I mean, I struggle to disagree with you in that moment. It's especially too, like this was a season where Charlotte was not just coming in with a new affiliation and two affiliates, but coming off a season where they didn't play the season before in the COVID year. So like to also ask questions of like, you know, are the fans going to come back in the same droves? How are they going to react to, hey, literally none of the guys that were on the team the last time you were here, save for maybe Max McCormick, by just pure happenstance, were, you know, are going
not
to be
even him. No, yes. No one in the cup was there. I mean, Chase Prisky was on the team for the first half of that season, then got traded, and then ultimately ended up coming back anyway. But not even Max McCormick, no one whose name is on the cup from the cup year in 2018-19 is here in Charlotte, which is incredible. You know, there's a handful of those guys, McCormick and Prisky and Dalpy were the three who have been in Charlotte at one point or another in their career. But yeah.
Yeah, it's to be able to triumph over that, to go through – I mean, especially for Jordy Kinnear, like that's a big task too, not just to manage, not just your own affiliate and the people who sign your paychecks, but someone else's, and have, you know, Dan Bylsma in the room, who's technically your assistant coach, but is also a cup winning coach and an NHL coach with quite a pedigree in his own right, who's there to kind of look over your shoulder. Like that's gotta be a little bit intimidating as well. And the fact that they managed to find a good balance for how that was going to work, as well as, you know, have success on the ice during the season, have, you know, overcome some strange moments of adversity when, you know, both affiliates are like, hey, we need all of your guys right now. To be able to, you know, not just have a successful season, but a division winning season, you know, you won a playoff round. For the most part, I think gave fans a good time throughout the year. And I mean, I will always credit the Charlotte front office for some of the stuff they do. They very much seem to get it in terms of how to market the team and sell the team. I love the back-to-back-to-back Calder Cup champion merchandise that you guys made. That was very fun. Which, spoiler alert, may be appearing on our, you know, YouTube background next season. But it's been a lot of fun, and I think Charlotte definitely had a success. Would everyone like to have them, you know, go back to back to back to back for a Calder Cup? Of course. But I think that it's silly that it's like only one team gets to call the season a success, and that's the champions, and everyone else fit. Like, that's silly. I think a lot of teams had qualified successes or outright successes a season. I think Charlotte was definitely one of them.
Yeah, I think whenever you're analyzing whether or not your season is a success, you have to look at the season before it, right? And maybe even the season before that, because if you're like Springfield, I mean, this is their first ever playoff run as the Springfield Thunderbirds. They haven't even lost a game yet in this postseason. I'd say even if they get swept by Laval, that's a successful season. You know, you have to look back at, granted, they too didn't play last year, but you have to look back at, you know, where did you come from and how did you get here? You know, yes, if Chicago ends up winning the Calder Cup, many people might even argue that that was, it's certainly very impressive, but many might say, well, considering the fact that all those guys just won the Cup 2 years ago, how much did they move the needle compared to, say, a team that was in last place in the division that made their way into the postseason and got a couple rounds deep before being knocked off? But ultimately, at the end of the day, everybody just wants to hoist that cup, and right now it's down to four teams, so someone's going to figure it out.
I think so too. And I think from a developmental perspective, it you know, you saw good steps and good moves forward for a lot of guys on Charlotte this year. I thought Grigory Denisenko took a good step this year. Logan Hutsko, same thing. You know, Cole Schwint, I thought, made progress. Alexander True, even though he's starting to age out of what you would typically think of as a prospect, I think is someone who has at least a shot at making an NHL roster at a training camp next year. Joey Decord, big step forward for him, at least outside of the series. I thought he made a big strides forward. But it seems like in all phases went pretty well, all things considered. CeCe, do you have any thoughts, since, you know, I've kind of cut you off, I think, twice now?
Well, I mean, I think the big thing for Springfield is the guy in net made Charlotte go 0-for-3. In this series. So, that's all I got.
Can we mute him, please?
I'll mute myself. How about that?
Oh, that was one of your better jokes, but man, you couldn't have waited for TJ to leave before you dropped that one. That's
brutal. The wound is fresh. I'm sorry. Hey. I'm so sorry. It was low hanging fruit. I had to grab it.
I'm part of the team. I can take it. I can take it too. But back to your point, Sean. No, you're absolutely right. I think that was the one thing with the Checkers, that they were so well balanced this season in terms of plenty of veterans getting involved, the Dalpies, the Wilsons, the Carricks, plenty of those middle range guys like you talked about, in Alexander True. And then, of course, there's plenty of the younger guys, the Hutskos, the Schwints, the Sarah Noels, all kind of coming up from the bottom. So it was great to see that they kind of had that even keel. You know, they were across the board, nobody was really out of their depths. It wasn't like this is a team that was pulled by one line. This isn't like it was a team that was even pulled by one affiliate necessarily. It's going to be very fun to see what this team looks like next year, because when you look at, you know, obviously Seattle's going to be moving out to Coachella Valley, so we're going to lose a handful of players. But Florida has done their homework and has a lot of guys prepared in the wings that didn't get the opportunity to play because of the Seattle guys that'll make their step, and a lot of college free agent signings and things like that. It's going to be a fun year next year.
One more thing too, that I just want to point out before we make that smooth transition to, you know, who's staying, who's going, who's free agent. One thing I will say is this is also a big step forward for Florida in learning to develop players, because it seemed like for years Florida never developed anyone and would just be signing, you know, bottom six guys in free agency every year instead of trying to turn a 21-year-old fourth round pick into an NHL player. So like to see strides forward for guys in the Florida prospect pipeline is important for them, because it's something that they've just not been good at in recent years. And to see them kind of do that is, I think, a good step forward too. But let's dive into, as you mentioned, because this is going to be a little bit different of a look ahead for Charlotte next year, because you have guys who are headed to Seattle, whether Coachella Valley or to the Kraken. CeCe, would you like to take the leaving for a different team and UFAs, or leaving for a different team or under contract, or free agent guys?
I'm going to take the free agent guys. I'll let you go first.
All right. So, who is under contract for next year that is going to Coachella Valley and or Seattle is Joey Decord, Luke Henneman, and Max McCormick. The guys who are under contract in the Florida Panthers organization, where they end up, we don't know, but they'll at least still be there. Cole Schwint, Connor Bunneman, Zach Dalpy, Grigory Denisenko, Max Gildon, Patrick Giles, Logan Hutsko, John Ludvig, and Sarah Noel. CeCe, hit me with the UFAs, and then we'll talk about who we think resigns. Then we'll dive into RFAs.
Okay. We're going to start with Christopher Gibson. We'll go to Connor Carrick, Gustav Olofsson, Chase Prisky and Scott Wilson. Not a very big list, just five guys.
Yeah, and I think some of that plays because we're not listing the Seattle guys who are going to be UFAs, because that
right.
A little bit of a weird break here. I guess technically speaking, they could be returning, but that got messy, especially when we get to RFAs, where it's like, well, Florida could offer sheet them. But so I think of that group of UFAs, I could see Christopher Gibson coming back. The rest, I think, are coin tosses. Like Prisky, I think, is the most likely of the rest of them. TJ, do you have any inside leanings there that you can, you know, maybe blink to us in Morse code about who you think is going to come back or not come back?
I will tell you that I know nothing about any of the leanings in terms of what I'm about to say is nothing more than my pure speculation. What I think, if any of the guys are listening to this or anyone in the organization is listening to this and you're going, TJ, what are you talking about? I'm just going, I'm talking about what my gut tells me and what I think.
From the hip.
I've been wrong before, but look, this is a podcast. We're talking about next season. I will give you my gut instincts. Could they be right? Maybe. Are they wildly wrong? Probably. But it doesn't matter. Chase Prisky, I do think Florida really likes him. We saw him make his NHL debut earlier this year. He's a Florida kid out of Pembroke Pines, Florida, not too far away from Sunrise. So there is a great storyline there. And though he didn't live too long there, he was only there, I think, until he was like 10 or 11 before moving up into the Northeast, which is why I went to Quinnipiac. He's someone that they really like. And their young D-core is going to be important going forward. When you look at that Florida Panthers back end, it's a lot of older guys. I mean, it's just one of those things where I think the area that they've done the best job at in terms of prospects and grooming these guys is the defense. When you talk about Prisky, you talk about Matt Kierstead, he's a rookie. He just finished his rookie season this year. I think he's going to be a big piece to Florida's plans, if not next year, the year after. Another guy that made an NHL debut earlier this year. So they're going to be fine on defense. Christopher Gibson, it'll be his 10th year pro. I know the Checkers have under, or I should say the Panthers have Evan Fitzpatrick under contract. They also have amateur signing of Matt Guzda, who was with us for a little while through that postseason run, just kind of hanging around out of the Barry Colts in the OHL. So where he ends up, I don't know. Max Gildon, I'd love to see a little bit more from him. He was hurt for most of the season, so I think, you know, he might be one of those guys, along with John Ludvig, that start NHL training camp, maybe find their way back to Charlotte if they end up re-signing or where their contract situations are. I don't even remember which one was on which list, but you know, those pieces are going to be pretty good. I think a lot of people fear, especially the casual fan, go, oh my God, the Checkers are going to lose DeCord. They're going to lose True. They're going to lose McCormick, but you kind of forget all these other guys that were injured. Denisenko is another one. You know, he's someone that has some NHL talent, but he got hurt and he missed half the season. So where does he start the year? Does he funnel down to Charlotte? Who knows? But that's kind of where I sit with those guys.
All right, CeCe, give me the RFAs here. Another short list.
Yeah, pretty short with a couple guys that you mentioned. Restrict free agents, Henry Bowlby, Alexi Heppaniemi, German
Rupsov.
German Rupsov. I'm just reading. Yeah. Some it's like Hermione and Hermine or Hermone, whatever you were saying, what you read with Harry Potter. Anyway, and then last but not least, Matt Kierstead. So those four.
I mean, I think it's pretty clear. Bowlby and Heppaniemi are getting qualifying offers. There's no way that Florida lets them go. I think Kierstead probably gets one too. But I would be genuinely surprised if German Rupsov gets a qualifying offer from Florida. That seems like a piece that has just never quite lived up to the draft day that he was chosen with, and has kind of just bounced around in bottom six of the AHL and has never really shown for more than a flash or a game or a weekend that he's someone who has a higher level that he can get to. He was, I think, a scratch for even when he got traded over from Lehigh Valley in the Claude Giroux trade. Just never seemed like he found a fit in Charlotte. And he's someone that it wouldn't shock me to have Florida not give him a QO and he walks to, Europe somewhere or takes like a flyer at the ECHL level and tries to make an AHL squad that way. But I don't think he comes back. TJ, any leanings?
I would tend to agree with you there, particularly on the Europe path. I don't know this for sure, but when I look at that Claude Giroux, Owen Tippett trade, I almost feel like Bunneman and Rubsov were thrown in because Lehigh Valley knows they need to rebuild here in the next couple of years. They need to off some of these guys that were just kind of hanging around and weren't necessarily living up to their expectations or living up to what Lehigh Valley, Philadelphia thought that they were going to be. But I was pleasantly surprised with Connor Bunneman. He came right in, was almost slotted. He was slotted into the lineup the day he got with the Checkers and really was only scratched a handful of times. And he really impressed me in the postseason with his physical play. So I think they may send out. I think was he an unrestricted free agent?
Bunneman is under contract. So
okay. He'll be a big piece coming forward. But Rubsov, I feel like they weren't necessarily as thrilled with him and might have just taken him on just to facilitate that deal and make sure that everything went through.
Yeah, and that was kind of my feeling too, is like, hey, make sure you send us a player back or send us one or two guys back. Like, I don't care who it is, just whoever you need to send us. And I think they probably looked at Bunneman, but like, it would be shocking if, we heard in the behind the scenes that like, oh no, Florida really wanted Garmin Rubsov. I'd have been like, really now? That's okay.
The only reason why I could think that they would ever really say that is because they know that they are losing a good chunk of the roster going to Coachella Valley because of the Seattle guys. And you're just looking for AHL caliber guys that can maybe compete for a roster spot, next season. But with him being, a free agent here, and seeing everything else that's developed and all the guys that they have signed, I just don't know if there's a fit for him here. If he would have come out and played up to the level that Connor Bunneman played, who I thought certainly outplayed him during his tenure here in Charlotte, then okay, we might be having a different conversation about that. Maybe they send him a qualifying offer just to keep him around and see if he can win one of those, bottom six spots. But I don't think he played well enough to earn that.
No, I agree with you. All right, TJ, I think that's about all we have to say about Charlotte. It's clearly, sun setting behind you there. So we're going to let you go. I'm amazed that, you aren't being swarmed by, mosquitoes and other insects out there in the wild. But thank you so much for spending time with us. If people didn't know where to find you already, that would be kind of shocking. You're the Charlotte Checkers broadcaster. If you're a Checkers fan, I imagine you know TJ. But where can people find you on the interwebs these days?
Twitter is my favorite spot, @TJ_ my last name, Chillot, Chillot. If you're watching on YouTube, it's right there, @TJ_ and my last name. But just, I love interacting with you guys. I love having you. It's a long off season. So if you need some guests to come on and just talk about, Penn State, Mississippi, Charlotte, whatever, we can run the gamut. I'm always around for you guys.
All right. Sounds good, TJ. Thank you so much for coming on. We appreciate your time. We will definitely have you on, probably not in consecutive episodes for a while, but definitely back at some point.
We'll talk to you soon. Thanks, guys.
All right. Take it
easy. Thanks, TJ.
All right. Time to shift to the Central Division postmortem here, as Milwaukee did not quite live up to the bar. Spoiler alert. And we decided to bring along a friend to help us, break down what happened. Regular on the show at this point, from On the Future, the prospect side of On the Forecheck for the Nashville Predators. We welcome back Eric Dunay. Eric, welcome back I don't even remember how many times you've been on the show now. I think this is four, maybe. You're practically a co-host.
Something like that, yeah. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. All right, Cece, let's cover the bases here. Give me the scores, talk about picks.
Yeah. So Chicago taking game one, 6-2. Game two, Chicago also taking that one, 8-2. Game three, Milwaukee coming back from the brink of elimination, 4-2. The Admirals taking that game. And then game four, Chicago once again putting up a lot of goals, 5-1 against the Admirals. And the Wolves taking the best of five series, 3-1. And picks, all on the same page here. I said the Wolves have been on a trajectory to win the Central in both the regular season and the postseason since late 2021. Nothing in Milwaukee's play as of late changes that for me. And so I picked Chicago. John, you said it was very hard for you to see a path here for Milwaukee, with Chicago looking so dominant, the Admirals, you know, seeming to stumble backwards into that series, you know, and regarding, you know, their previous series against Manitoba. You went with the Wolves. Sean's analytics model had Chicago as a 61.6% favorite. Pretty high favorite there from the analytics model. And in a rare twist of fate, the three picks, me, Sean, and the model, going in Chicago's way. Sorry, Eric. But normally when we do that, that's the death knell for that team. But it ended up boding well for our selections anyway. So
I think that's in the future, I want to find out if that's actually true, if we're just kind of, you know, like, I feel like we don't do that bad when we're all on the same side, but we always definitely, it feels like when I see, you know, all three of them, it's like, maybe I should have picked the other side just to be safe. But yeah, no, this one was one where I felt like our preview really did pretty good justice for how this series played out. For Milwaukee to win, we said they needed to keep Chicago from starting hot and dominating the opening minutes. They did not do that. Chicago outscored them 7-1 in the first period, and Chicago outshot them 49-34 in the first period. Biggest other big key was that we needed Milwaukee to play boring, physical, kind of low event, grind it down hockey. If they turned this into a north-south, you know, race through the neutral zone, you know, trading chances, that was not going to go well for them. And to their credit, they at least tried very hard to do that. I felt like Milwaukee had some good sequences and stretches where they were able to take away Chicago's north-south transition game. They forced the Wolves to play dump and chase in stretches, in moments. They just couldn't execute that game plan well enough or long enough to be effective. Because when Chicago got loose, they got loose. I think there were definitely some things, though, that the ads did right in those moments, though, and I think Mitch Love and the rest of the Heat staff are going to have some interesting film sessions because of it, but ultimately not enough for Milwaukee. Our big X factor in the series was the Admirals' goaltending, and across all situations, the Admirals' goaltending, whether Devin Cooley or Connor Ingram, combined for an .862 save percentage. That will never be good enough to win games in the playoffs. The Wolves certainly flirted with danger in the last two games of the series, giving up 12 power plays combined, but they managed to weather that storm in game four. Here we are. Eric, what did you see from Milwaukee this series?
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head with pretty much of everything. If you had told me going into this series that it would be the goaltending that it would lose the series for them, I would be shocked. That said, I don't necessarily think a Connor Ingram who was playing up to his standards would have won them this series either. It's certainly more possible than the 8:35. Well, that includes his game against Manitoba, but the sub 8:50 goaltending he gave them, which is kind of shocking. But outside of that, I mean, this team was never going to generate offense on the level that Chicago could. They were never going to be as quick as Chicago could be, and they were prone to take more penalties than Chicago likely would too. Although you pointed out, you know, Chicago kind of flirted with danger there in the past couple games. Ultimately, I don't think the Admirals had any real chance of getting out of the series. And if they had even the slightest of hopes, it was going to require Connor Ingram to stand on his head. And he did the complete opposite, in fact. So
it was funny for me too, because I remember going into the second game, and I briefly replied to one of your tweets on Twitter about, you know, should maybe this be a Devin Cooley game? And I kind of soft pedaled the idea that I was like, I think Devin Cooley should maybe start that game, because it was one for me where it was just, it was a back-to-back, and starting your goalies in back-to-back games is usually not going well for that goaltender. They're tired, that kind of thing, especially for the effort that, you know, Ingram had to go through in the game before where he got shelled. It seemed like a good moment to start Cooley there, as well as, you know, in the handful of minutes that Connor Ingram had played in the playoffs for the ads so far, he did not look great. And I think that game two performance definitely helped solidify that. But it also allowed, I think, you know, Carl Taylor to have kind of an out should it not work. It's like you have an excuse that when you, you know, give Cooley the start, you can present to Ingram's like, look, it's a back-to-back. You know, we want you to be rested for game three, which, you know, is going to be an important game for us no matter the outcome of this one. And if we do lose tonight, we'd rather go back to you, our number one, for a do or die at home. Whereas, you know, if you start Ingram in game two, he plays badly, then you go to game three and it's like, well, do we bench our number one goaltender for most of the season in a do or die game? for a guy who's been hot, or do we ride the guy who's maybe been, you know, a little overworked recently and one of the most, you know, exhausted goaltenders from a minutes played perspective in this game? Like, I felt like it kind of painted you into a corner that would be like, no matter what happens, if you start Connor Engram in game two, your choices for game three are almost all kind of shady if he doesn't perform well. And I think that was more my concern. But when they went to Devin Cooley for game three, I was surprised. That was, I thought, the correct move, but one that would take a lot of gusto to be able to say, like, hey, our number one goalie is playing not well right now. Like, I still think Engram is unquestionably overall the better goaltender than Devin Cooley, and, you know, a handful of good playoff games and bad ones don't shake that for me. I'm still expecting him to take the backup role to Juuse Saros next year. But to put that dude, you know, in a baseball hat sitting by himself for a do or die game at home, that's a big, bold move. And I'm not saying that, you know, Carl Taylor was wrong. I would have done the same thing, but, like, I wouldn't have blamed him for not being able to pull the trigger on that. That's a bold one.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, that was kind of the corner they'd been painted into all season. Like you pointed out, in terms of Engram's exhaustion, they had to ride him so much during the regular season because Devin Cooley was quite bad, to be honest, and couldn't really be trusted. I think there were a good handful of games where he played really well in the regular season, but overall, there wasn't the level of confidence that you had with Engram. And on top of that, you know, Saros gets hurt, Engram goes up to the NHL, takes over the net from Dave Rittich. So he's coming back from, you know, albeit it was just four games, but a playoff series in the NHL, still tired from the regular season. And you get to the playoffs, right, and Devin Cooley stands on his head in round one while Engram's in the NHL. And it's a surprise. Like, he looks like a completely different goaltender than what we saw most of the regular season. And so you start to ask yourself, okay, you know, is this a hot hand we can ride? Is this the real Devin Cooley, or is this a flash in the pan, right? And we don't have enough sample size from the regular season to really know, because again, Connor Engram played so much. So I certainly get going to Connor Engram. He was your workhorse all year. He remains the team's best goalie. Like you said, he's going to be Saros' backup next year. And despite Cooley's performances in round one, you ultimately, you know, I wouldn't say could be 100% sure he was going to keep that going. He ultimately played very well in game three against the Wolves, but you know, I still don't trust Devin Cooley in nearly any circumstance starting over Connor Engram.
I wouldn't either. I'm curious to see what happens, you know, next season for the Admirals. Let me quickly scroll down here and make sure that Devin Cooley is a restricted free agent. Yeah. And I imagine he's going to get a QO. Like, that would be a shocker to me if they let him walk. Or if someone offer sheets him. Like, nobody offer sheets guys anymore. This league can't be fun. But I imagine he's going to be back next year. And I'm curious to see what happens with him in camp. Like I said, I'm just assuming that Connor Engram walks right into the Predators camp and leaves with a backup spot, unless he is truly, you know, terrible in that role and out on Broadway getting drunk every night during the training camp. Like, aside from something wild like that happening, which would be way out of character for him, I'm expecting him not to put on an Admirals jersey unless it's a conditioning stint next year. So I think, I agree. I think Devin Cooley, at least this season, is not the superior goaltender, although in the last four games he certainly looked like it. I'm curious to see if he's able to build on that from the offseason, you know, ending the season on probably the highest note he can while still losing. And if he's able to make that into progress that seems more sustainable, that would be an interesting move, because he's not, if I remember correctly, like, he's not an old, you know, guy who's just is who he is at this point. He is, and I have to look this up because I don't know everyone's,
he's like 25,
yeah, like, yeah. So he's the same age as Connor Engram. Like,
yeah,
that's a little late in, you know, the development game, even for a goalie to, you know, be finding their A-plus game, but at the same point, it's not unheard of. So I'd be curious to see kind of if he's able to build on that coming into camp, into the season next year, is what I'm just going to assume is, well, Askarov.
Yeah. See, that's the tough thing with him, right? Is it's effectively going to be like a three-way race for the starting job next year, really like two and a half between him, Askarov, and Tomas Vomashka. But like, the Nashville has all the incentive in the world to be starting Askarov, whether he's better or not. Like, yes, Devin Cooley's career is not over, and I think he can certainly improve, but like, I do not think Devin Cooley will ever be an NHL goaltender. And when you're, even if, you know, that's a possibility, you're going to be investing a lot more time and resource into your 11th overall draft pick than you are a college free agent that you signed, who was, I think, probably always destined to be an AHL level goalie to begin with. So he's kind of in a tough place, even if he can build on it for next season, but we'll have to see.
Yeah. I forgot about the legend of Askarov, because, well, I still can't believe that they brought him all the way over from Russia to let him, you know, chill in the press box for those games. Like, I thought for sure the signing of him meant he was going to play, but the hell do I know?
Yeah, I think that was mostly part, like, I mean, David Poyle's hinted at this a handful of times, and I've been trying to kind of pry the whole story out of the organization. It's seemingly a genuinely significant breakdown in Askarov's relationship with St. Petersburg. He was effectively benched this year, not even in the KHL, but like beneath that. So I think part of it was really just to get him here, helping him learn English, get him around the team and the organization. Because what is he going to be doing over there? He didn't even go to their MHL team when they went all the way to the championship and won that. So he was effectively sitting at home doing nothing. So I kind of get it. And you're not going to, like, unless something crazy happens, you were going to throw a guy who had barely played in a few months, who just, you know, came across the Atlantic in the net in a playoff game, unless you absolutely needed to. So,
yeah, that's fair. I can see that a little bit. I was surprised, because it seemed like, I mean, anything that he's done since getting drafted, or even before that, it was always just the, you know, giant hype train that followed him. And, you know, I typically don't start watching goaltenders or players or skaters or ever until they are in the AHL orbit, because, well, I have a life too. And he was one where I'm just like, all right, I'm seeing a lot of people who are smarter than I am about goaltenders telling me that this kid is for real. I choose to believe them. I haven't seen anything yet. And apparently I'm going to have to wait a little bit longer to dive deeper on him until we do season previews for next year. But like, it was a little bit shocking to me. All right, let's transition over here. Eric will ask you, do you think of this Milwaukee Admirals season in sum as a success, a failure, or somewhere in between?
It's really hard to say. I think you saw three or four different Admirals teams this year. So I guess it depends on which one you're asking the question about. If you're asking it about the team that came into the season with aspirations of contending for a championship, I would say it's a failure. If you're asking it about the team that was in last place in the league in December, then you'd say it's probably a success. You know, ultimately, like, this team won the organization's first playoff series in over a decade. They largely backed their way into that win, but they won it nonetheless. And that's a big deal. You know, they've really struggled in the first round of the playoffs. You know, I think there's still kind of a bit of taste in a lot of mostly fans, you know, mouths about the COVID ended season, where they were miles ahead of the rest of the league. But that didn't seem to be the sense in the locker room when I spoke to Carl Taylor before the season. So, you know, overall, I'd say there were a lot of positives. I think you got a lot of really great developmental minutes from players like Mark Delgaiso, from players like David Ferentz. He was allowed to make mistakes, from players like Igor Afanasyev. You know, you got a 20 goal season out of Cole Smith in his first full AHL year, which I probably didn't see coming. So there were certainly some positives. You know, the team's going to be happy that they won that playoff series. But ultimately, you know, if everything had gone right, and Rocco Grimaldi had never gotten hurt, and Matt Luff had never gone up to the AHL, you know, full time, and all sorts of things, you know, this was a roster on paper that could have contended for a championship. And ultimately they ran into a buzzsaw of a Wolves team that is probably, you know, is going to be hard to stop here moving forward.
Yeah, for sure. I think I see it kind of the same way of, like, I remember our preseason when we were doing previews, and it was like, yeah, it's hard to see Milwaukee in any scenario, but, you know, second or third, winning the division outright, or, you know, very much contending for a division. Like, they looked on paper at the beginning of the season, have a roster that was going to be, you know, deep and talented, and hard to see a way for them to just crash and burn. And man, did Crash and Burn was their opening month and a half of the season. Oh, yeah. I remember watching games from, it's like, geez, they're asleep at the wheel here. And it was like, it was, I was glad they were able to turn it around because it made me feel like I wasn't seeing ghosts in the preseason when we were like, yeah, this is a legitimate contender. And they managed to get into the playoffs and, you know, turn their season around. So there are definitely some elements where I agree with you, where it's like from the entire sum from, you know, October to present, I can see how it feels like a failure. But given that they dug themselves out from a very massive hole at the beginning of the season, I feel like that it's a qualified success. It's success with an asterisk. Of, you know, we're not unhappy of how the season went, but there are definitely ways in which we would have liked to have gone a little bit better.
I do think it's also important to note real quick that, like, you know, one, they didn't make the playoffs because of the expanded playoff format. Like, they would have made the playoffs under the old format, which is good. And two, you know, in the year that we shifted to varying schedule lengths, they played the most games of the, you know, whatever marks they were, 68, 72, 76, whatever, they were in 76 when a lot of teams around them and in their division weren't. So just two other things that, you know, when we finally get like schedule stability moving forward in this league will hopefully kind of be mitigated.
Definitely. And I think too that they did get some good steps forward, as you mentioned, in development too. You know, not a ton of, you know, big sexy prospects in Milwaukee this year, but guys who, you know, hey, if you can get someone to pan out from a third or fourth round pick or later, they'll always take it. I did see good things from Afanasyev, like you said, good things from Mark Delgado, good things from David Ferentz, very good things from Connor Ingram, obviously. I think next year is going to be a big one for a couple of those guys. I'm interested to see what Juuso Parsonen does, because I don't think he was necessarily, you know, coming in limited time, still young, still kind of learning the North American game. But I thought he was at least impressive in, you know, given the role that he was given in the minutes that he played. I think he's going to be the most interesting guy to watch next season, just in terms of what success for him could mean for Nashville. But let's look ahead a little bit and see, you know, who's under contract and who can walk and who, I guess, could theoretically be given an offer sheet if this league were fun. Cece, you've been quiet for a while over there. Would you like to take the UFAs or the free agent-ish guys or the guys who are under contract?
I'll take the ones under contract.
All right.
So we'll dive in there. Igor Afanasyev, Mark Delgado, Juuso Parsonen, Connor Ingram. He's coming back. That's good for them. Grant Mismash, one of the funnest names in the AHL. Matthew Olivier, Cole Schneider, Matt Tennyson, like you guys mentioned him earlier, Michael McCarron, Adam Wilsby, and Yaroslav. Is it Askarov or how'd you pronounce it, Eric?
Askarov,
yes. Because I know we've been pronouncing it the first way. And yeah, the Russian names are difficult sometimes.
They are. I think it's because a lot of them have that, like, in English, it's you. The hard sound is that first
syllable.
Thank you.
Yep, I'm good for something around here.
Yep, that first syllable. Whereas in a lot of Russian names, the hard syllable is that second one. So you get like Askarov instead of Askarov. So.
Varlamov. Yes, Colorado. We were familiar with that for a while. So.
On the UFA side here for Milwaukee, Alex Biega, Jeremy Davies, Cole Sherwood, Rocco Grimaldi, and Braden Burke. I mean, I'm assuming that they bring Grimaldi back, even though he's a UFA. But
he is almost certainly gone.
Really?
I mean, they just – it's not so much – well, I actually do think it's they don't really want him back. It's – I mean, you know, we're, I think, 2 years removed from – David Poile telling him he could buy a house in Nashville. And that was like the first time he had heard that in his career. And then, you know, in the expanded playoffs a couple years ago, he was not very good and ultimately got benched, you know, started the season in Nashville, was ultimately set down. And they, they would have probably had to have gone through the entire Milwaukee roster before they would have called him up at the end of the season. So I think it's just at a point where, like, it's clear he's not going to get a full-time NHL role. That's what he wants and thinks he can get. you know, I'll leave that determination up to other teams. So I would almost certainly say that Grimaldi will be walking in free agency.
That's fair. I mean, if it were up to me, he stays. I mean, I'm still amazed that Nashville can't, like, I understand, you know, he didn't have a great year for Nashville in seven games this year, but like, he has 2 10-goal campaigns for a guy who plays, you know, bottom 6 minutes. That's not, you know, nothing to just throw away. But if that's what they're willing to do, somebody is going to snatch him up. Like, I mean, Arizona needs to put bodies on that NHL roster. I think that's one where I'm going to be interested to see what they do next year, because like, they have like 3 guys under contract for the next season, and everyone else is just, you know, and they're very clearly not trying to win. So I'd be curious to see what kind of, you know, guys who feel like they're right on that cusp between the AHL and the NHL, how many of them end up in Arizona looking for, you know, NHL minutes that are guaranteed to somebody. So I think he would be a good candidate for that. I can't imagine Cole Sherwood comes back. That was my, like, that dude is not coming back.
Healthy scratch through almost the entire playoffs.
Yeah, and even in the games he was in, like, he had a couple of shining moments, but, like, the Cole Sherwood that was playing for his hometown, you know, Cleveland Monsters, Columbus Blue Jackets organization, and the one that played this year are different Cole Sherwoods. You could tell that he definitely missed being, you know, in his home state, in his hometown, playing for a team and organization that he felt personally about, versus like when he was in Belleville to start the year and then came to Milwaukee and just never seemed like he was there. Like, he never seemed to find, you know, his role, his rhythm with anybody. And part of me wonders if he walks back to Cleveland on an AHL-only deal if he can.
I was going to ask you, CeCe, any chance his brother can pull some weight and get him out your neck of the woods?
I mean, you know, the fact that brothers play together, I mean, we saw it, what, in San Diego a couple seasons ago with the Carricks? And, I mean, Kiefer, if Kiefer re-signs in Colorado, you know, he's a free agent as well. But if Kiefer and Cole want to get the brothers back together, I mean, they could be the Blues brothers, and they're on a mission from God in Loveland, Colorado.
It's crazy watching them this year. And I was like, wow, like, Kiefer's putting up, like, Grimaldi, you know, Podorowski, like, a level season, right? And Cole is just, I mean, effectively a 13 forward at this point. It's really crazy how much they've diverged.
Yeah. If I would say, yeah, if Cole wants to kind of get that rejuvenation that he had in Cleveland, and like Sean, you know, talked about being in his home and everything, I think having his brother there and coming to Colorado, if Kiefer were to resign, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, stay tuned for a Blues Brothers reunion. So
I know one Sakura is a UFA coming up. Are both of them? CeCe, go.
Yes, both Dylan Sakura and Kiefer Sherwood are
no. The other agents, Sakura,
but,
Tyler.
But the other Sakura, right? Tyler Sakura. Okay,
yeah, look that up while I read the RFA. So okay, restricted free agents here: Matt Luff, Cody Glass, Tommy Novak, Cole Smith, David Ferentz, and Devin Cooley. Anybody from that list, Eric, that you think does not get a qualifying offer?
No. I mean, yeah, not really. Cooley is, I mean, I really doubt it, but he would be the only one at risk. I think the other, you know, Matt Luff is interesting. They seem to really like him as an extra forward in Nashville, and I think he's fine in that position. He's very much a 4A player at the AHL level in my mind at this point. But then again, are you going to keep, if Cody Glass is coming up, if Tommy Novak's, you know, competing for a spot in training camp, are you going to keep Matt Luff and Michael McCarron around? Who's to say? I very much prefer one of them over the other, and I'll let you decide which one that is. And unfortunately, it's not the one that has a contract for next year. So, but yeah. And then I think the one other, well, Ferentz is also an RFA, but he'll be back. And then the one other one is Jimmy Huntington too. Him and Braden Burke, I think, were both really good down the stretch for this team. I was sad to see Frederick Allard go, but much like Anthony Richard, it was kind of time to move on for both parties. And Huntington and Burke were a real key to the Admirals' depth scoring down the stretch and in the playoffs. So I think those are both good players. You know, will we ever get the Braden Burke we had in the first year in Tucson again? Who's to say? But I think those are both very solid, you know, top six wingers/centers for Huntington's purpose that this team will probably bring back next season.
All right, CeCe, what's the verdict?
Tyler Sekera is a unrestricted free agent this offseason. So Sekera and Sherwood, the Blues Brothers times two.
It's funny, too, how many in the Pacific Division, how many pairs of brothers there are, whether one brother plays in the Pacific or both of them play in the Pacific. It is a very much a division of brotherly love. I would love
the Magnas, the Middletons. Yeah. Yeah.
The Carricks. The
Carricks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like it's, I think that would be fun if every team in the Pacific had its own pair of brothers on it. That should be, can we make that a rule?
Yeah, just send Liam Foodie over from the Columbus organization as well.
Yeah, you know what?
There you go, another.
Let it go. That's definitely what's happening here.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Any closing thoughts here on the season, Eric, for the Milwaukee Admirals as a whole here?
I think no real closing thoughts on the season. I think looking ahead, this team's going to be really interesting next year. On one hand, there's going to be a lot of new faces. On the other hand, you know, which is challenging, right? On the other hand, I think a lot of those new faces are very exciting talents. You know, we mentioned Yusuf Parsonen earlier, who I've been banging the drum for a couple years now, who's looking very much like a seventh round gem. When he came over to North America after his Liga season this year, they actually weren't even planning to play him, but ultimately got in the lineup because of some illnesses here and there, and they the coaching staff was so impressed right away that they put him as their second line center for the rest of the playoffs. So I think he's going to be a real key next year, especially if Cody Glass is in Nashville, which I expect, and potentially Tommy Novak as well. You've got Luke Evangelista coming in, who just led the OHL in goals this past year. You've got Adam Willsby, who's been a great defender over in Sweden. You've got Spencer Stastny, who Notre Dame's coach last spring or this past spring said he was maybe the best defenseman he's ever had at Notre Dame coming in. And then you get year two of Ferentz, you get year two of Delgado. You know, Jeremy Davies is probably gone, but you still have Matt Tennyson, and who knows if Matt Donovan will be back or if he retires. You got Luke Prokop coming in as well, who could be a Memorial Cup champion by that time. So a lot of fresh faces. I think it's going to be an exciting team. I think it's nice that all of these prospects in the organization who kind of have a big pedigree are going to be coalescing together on this roster. We'll see how Carl Taylor makes it work. But, you know, overall, a lot to look forward to. And at the very least, we finally get to watch Yaroslav Askarov play regular minutes, hopefully. So.
Yeah, I think that's going to be interesting. I also didn't think of that, too. It's like, yeah, there are a lot of, like, very interesting prospects for the Nashville organization, kind of all seeming like they're headed to Milwaukee next year, which you don't see a lot from teams. A lot of them, it seems like, kind of, they put most of them in the AHL when they can, but they're rather willing to let, you know, some of the guys who are in Sweden just stay in Sweden or in Russia or whatever, where they prefer, where they feel a little more comfortable. Whereas, like, if it were me and I were a GM, you know, God helps whatever team's stupid enough to hire me, but I would definitely be like, oh no, we are able to yank you from whatever league you're in and put you in our clutches in the AHL. Too bad. It must suck that you have to come here, but that's what's happening. Yeah. So I'm always surprised that, like, yeah, it does seem like there are going to be a lot of very interesting and, like, it's funny because we were talking earlier off camera about how, you know, I know your depth of knowledge with the Nashville pipeline is unmatched. And, like, you could name, you know, six guys I've literally never heard of. And yet, surprisingly, all of the ones you named, I have at least heard the name. And I'm like, oh, yeah, he's someone that's an interesting prospect for this organization. So, like, they have a lot of interesting pieces coming in. I think it's I think you're right that it's going to be a very fun season for Milwaukee next year. And hopefully they get off to a good start in fall instead of, you know, in January.
Yeah. Well, hey, don't worry. I've got one name to trip you up. Have you ever heard of Navarin Mutter?
Oh, come on. You pure made that up.
It's a real person. It's a real person. Just finished the season with the Kitchener Rangers. To be fair, he was never drafted. They signed him as a free agent a couple of months ago. And I'm almost certain he'll probably be starting the year in the ECHL, but he does exist. So
that's good to know. He's about as real as Blade Jenkins. One of my other favorite names in the AHL.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. Unfortunately, we have to wait a year for the Zachary LaRue suspension bonanza experience in the AHL, but Don't worry, it's coming.
Suspension bonanza experience.
Yeah, he really has been racking up the suspensions in the QMJHL the past couple years.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Fun. Well, yeah. Anyway, Eric, as always, thank you for coming on and lending us your expertise in all things Milwaukee Admirals. I'm sure if you haven't figured out where Eric is by now, if the number of times he's been on the show, I don't know what you're doing. But Eric, where can people find your brilliance online?
Sure. Yeah. You can follow me on Twitter at OnTheFutureOTF. And then you can see all of my writing at OnTheForecheck.com.
All right. Eric Dunay for On the Forecheck and On the Future, the Super Bowl Nation affiliate of the Nashville Predators. Thank you so much for coming on.
Of course. Thank you.
Thanks, Eric. Okay, we are down to our final post-mortem series, and it is the Stockton Heat against the Colorado Eagles, the Pacific Division Finals. And since I was kind of away, and we figured we'd bring on somebody to cover Colorado, and she has been covering Colorado for DNVR here in the Mile High City and in Loveland. She covers both the Colorado Eagles and the Colorado Avalanche for DNVR. So please welcome someone that I've met in person many a time. She's become a good friend, Megan Angley. Megan, welcome to the Calder Farmstead.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. Like I said, I've worked with you enough to know that you're going to bring the heat when it comes to the Eagles. Oh, that was a bad pun. That
maybe
was unintentional.
Not for this series post.
Hey, phrasing. Hey, phrasing. Yeah, that was poor. That was poor phrasing on my part. Let's get to how the series fleshed out for Stockton and Colorado. Game one, Stockton handily defeating the Colorado Eagles 5-0 over there in Stockton, California. Game two, much closer, better game played by Colorado. Still a Heat victory, this time only by a score of 1-0. Game three, we kick it back to Loveland. Colorado, 6-5. Barn burner, Jean-Luc Foudy in overtime, winning that game for the Eagles. Game four, Stockton, another 1-0 victory. Dustin Wolf's third shutout in the four games of the series. And that's another 1-0 victory for the Heat. Stockton winning that best of five series, 3-1. We're going to talk about the picks. And I said this is one that I felt could go the distance. I'd seen how Colorado wasn't afraid to get physical and temper attempts to overpower them. That wasn't really a factor in this series, at least not much as one as you'd think. That combined with the scoring prowess and overall skating depth, that led me to pick the Eagles. I felt it was going to go five games. Sean, you also picked Colorado. The model, Sean's analytics model, 58.6% favorite the Eagles were from the analytics model. So, of course, all three of us in cahoots, Stockton gets the victory. Yeah. And so Sean's going to give a little bit of what happened in games three and four. Again, me being in San Antonio, Texas, visiting the Alamo and the basement of the Alamo, of course. That's a Pee-wee's Big Adventure reference. If you guys haven't, no. Oh, wow.
Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Wow.
This is why I write the jokes.
Well, okay. Moving on. Let's talk about what happened in games three and four, because I was out of pocket.
So what happened was Stockton's disciplined forecheck and relentless pressure just continued. I mean, it was a lot of the same we saw from Stockton that was working really well for them. They, just managed to take time and space away from Colorado's high-octane offense, force them to play dump and chase. They took away passing lanes to the slot, took away passing lanes across Royal Road. They forced Colorado to the perimeter, and Colorado could not get inside often enough. I mean, one of the most well-executed and tightly played defensive performances I've seen in the AHL in this season, at least in three of the four games here. Game three, obviously, some offense got through, but pitching three shutouts in four games against one of the best offensive teams in the AHL in the regular season, it was downright impressive. And even in the moments when breakdowns happened defensively for Stockton, one of the best and steadiest netminders in the AHL was there to backstop them. And that was also what we saw a lot of, is when Colorado was able to finally, get a breakdown from Stockton, get a good scoring chance through, Dustin Wolf there just robbing them blind. The other big thing I saw for what helped Colorado, Colorado's downfall here, was taking bad penalties. Five penalties in game four, four of them were ones that I felt like were pretty avoidable. The Wingerly high sticking, Ryan Wagner's cross-checking penalty was lucky to be matched with a terrible embellishment call on Phillips. That too many men penalty, clear shot in the foot, and the Wagner tripping call, all ones that felt very unforced and not a, you know, guy on a breakaway that you have to do something for, just kind of making moves at the wrong time that weren't needed. Those didn't necessarily put Stockton on the board per se, but they definitely helped disrupt whatever Colorado had going for them, breaking up their momentum and forcing them to kind of, you know, try and create offense from the penalty kill, which has worked for them in the postseason at times, but clearly was not going to be as big a factor against a disciplined and well-prepared team like Stockton. Megan, that's what I saw from the series, unfortunately, for the Eagles. What did you see?
Pretty much mirroring a lot of what you talked about, because it would be a disservice to reduce Stockton to just the excellent goaltending, but a lot of what went wrong for the Eagles was their own doing. And there was a pattern that emerged in this series specifically where the Eagles took the first penalty of the game and it deflated a lot of their momentum. Also of note, Dennis Gilbert is not in this series as well, and he was a huge player on their penalty kill, which was near perfect throughout the postseason. They were missing him in the last series as well. But Andreas Englund kind of stepped up in that role on the penalty kill, and two of the three power play goals against happened with Englund in the box. And so this near perfect penalty kill that helped the Eagles to go the distance through this point was seriously lacking without Dennis Gilbert, and with irresponsible penalties being taken, the penalty kill just couldn't rise to the occasion, and it did hurt a lot of their momentum. They were unable to get offensive chances because they were playing on their own end most of the time.
Yeah, and Megan, something that I noticed was that, I mean, you know, you and I have noticed the depth that the Colorado Eagles have had, you know, this season, and really the fact that Stockton was the one that showed its depth. You know, they did not need Peltier to score, you know, really a whole ton of goals in those first two games, and for, you know, Kirkland to step up. And I mean, obviously you've got Phillips as well, but I mean, for Stockton to kind of show off a little bit of that depth and to really, you know, as we talked about last time and as we talked about this time, you know, neutralizing Colorado in the center of the ice, really making it difficult for them to get set up in the offensive end. And for Stockton to win two games, 1-0, and to shut out Colorado three times when they hadn't been shut out since November of 2019, you know, it's like Stockton came to play. And Sean said it pretty perfectly last episode. Heat head coach Mitch Love really tinkered with his strategy to make Colorado's life extremely difficult and extremely fruitless when it came to goals on the board. I mean, you could have surprised me in game number three and told me Adam Werner was in net instead of Dustin Wolf, because that was just kind of an aberration. And you're, I think, as a goaltender allowed to have one of those games. I mean, Sean's got a Patrick Waugh jersey on, and he, you know, his last game in that jersey was a 9-goal affair, if I remember correctly. So, but anyway, I digress. It's just, it's amazing to me how well Stockton adjusted, especially after, you know, losing that close game 3-6-5, and then coming back and winning another, again, Kirkland, the only goal in game four in that 1-0 win. It's like Stockton came to play, and they punched Colorado in the mouth with that freak goal in game one, that kind of just that backhand along the goal line that Eustace couldn't pinch the pole tight enough. And it just kind of went downhill from there in regards to the series.
For sure. And one of the other things too, is like, I would have thought if Colorado went down in the series, we'd be talking about, you know, our X factor for the series was Eustace Nunan. And we were like, he looked very good in the playoffs and in this series as well. But we, you know, having seen him a bunch in the regular season where he was good at times, bad at times, and seemed to struggle to find that consistency, it was hard to see his playoff performance before this series and say, okay, that's definitely the guy who he is. It was something that we were a little skeptical of. Like, he had played well and looked hot in the playoffs, but given his full body of work this season, it was something we could see unravel. And that wasn't the case here. We got that one wrong in our X factor here. Eustace Nunan played very, very well in this series. You know, Justin Kirkland goal line goal notwithstanding. Like, you know, you lose two games 1-0 as a goaltender. You give up one goal. You're expecting to get enough goal support that your team can do something to at least get you to overtime or give you a chance. But Eustace Nunan was not the reason Colorado lost the series. And I'm surprised that that wasn't a bigger story for it, but he played excellent for them. If nothing else, that's a high mark for him for his, you know, his work this postseason. And I'm sure his exit interview was like, well, I did all the stuff that I could. I don't know what more you could have asked from me.
That's a great point. The decline in Eustace's season began after the Pot of Gold game against Stockton earlier in the regular season. And it took a little bit for him to bounce back from that. And a lot of that came through in the postseason. And he just had an excellent series, but there wasn't enough in front of him to get them past this round.
Megan, I really feel like Dennis Gilbert missing. You mentioned him. Probably one of the best defensive players I've seen come through the Colorado Eagles in their 3 years of AHL existence. I mean, the man sold out for every, I mean, like you said, he was a penalty kill stall, you know, just stalwart on the penalty kill. I mean, it really, him missing, and then for Dylan Secure to come back at the beginning of the series and just not make as big of an impact as I thought he was going to. I mean, thoughts on both, like, Gilbert's, you know, being Gilbert being MIA and then Secure coming back and not really contributing as much as I thought that he was going to. What are your thoughts on those two guys?
For Gilbert specifically, I didn't expect his absence to have this big of an impact, but it's clear we've talked about the type of player he is. He's just completely a heart and passion guy. He would walk the concourse during games instead of sitting and watching them, I think, because he couldn't stand to be sitting down and watching the team instead of being able to play and to help them. So I think that's incredibly disappointing for him and speaks to the impact that he does have when he is in the lineup. And for Sakura, I'm giving him some allowances because a lot of the offensive star power for the Eagles didn't show up in addition to him. And that is kudos to Stockton playing as well as they did too and shutting down those opportunities. Like, they matched up line to line against the Eagles very well. And that was just an incredibly well-coached team, knowing that they needed to shut down Sherwood. They needed to shut down Sakura. They needed to shut down Maltsev, even Jordan Gross in a way. And so they matched up very well against this Eagles team. So of the Eagles roster, Sakura was still the one who offensively had the most impact, but that's not saying much with two shutouts.
I think the biggest surprise in the series for me from a who was in the lineup perspective was Shane Bowers didn't start this series. And I thought in the limited bits that I saw of him in the series against Ontario that he looked really good in the two games, you know, games 3 and 4 that he played for Colorado. I thought he looked really good and was surprised that he only played in 4 of Colorado's playoff games this season. I admittedly didn't get to see much of the regular season for the Eagles because usually when we cover the Eagles, that's a CC job and not a Sean job. But watching, you know, most of their playoff games this year, I was surprised because it seemed like the games he was in, he was making an impact and putting his thumb on the scale for the Colorado Eagles in a positive way, and was surprised to see him get yanked from the lineup to start the Stockton series and to not, you know, play against Henderson and miss game 1 against Ontario. Any thoughts, you know, from either of you, as you're both, you know, dialed in really closely, why Shane Bowers wasn't getting more, you know, into the lineup, even though he was clearly making an impact?
Go ahead, Megan.
It's an interesting topic of conversation that I think we've all talked about in the press box, because game 2, he comes in Ontario series and has an immediate impact, I think a goal and an assist. And then even in this series with Stockton, he has an immediate impact. He opens up the scoring in game 3. Even in game 4, where they get shut out, he leads the team in shots. He just unarguably had an impact when he was in the lineup. And it's difficult to watch because even Cronin talks about how he does everything right and he puts in the extra work. Something that I've noticed is he appeared to get stronger and quite literally put on weight from the regular season into the postseason. And I think that was an area maybe he was lacking before. So why he wasn't utilized in a larger role was a little bit confusing to me, because I think in that game 2 with Ontario last series, he played his way into the lineup. There's just a lot of forward depth kind of waiting in the balance that took precedence in that queue with a young prospect like Olsson and even Sample Ranta bringing different things to the table. For Olsson, it's his shot. For Ranta, it's his physicality. But I felt like Bowers really rose to the occasion in improving those elements of his game as well. So it was a little confusing, but the best I could sum it up to is maybe a little too little too late, because there were games in the regular season where he just wasn't really visible unless he was skating. And that definitely shined in the postseason, but maybe it just wasn't enough in the regular season to solidify his place in the lineup.
And Megan, you mentioned how, you know, Bauer's putting on weight and just the physicality of play, just in general from the Eagles. From Henderson and Ontario, I felt like the Eagles had to play a more physical game. And I mentioned that last episode too. I feel like the Eagles really had to dial it up, and it really showed in the Ontario series with how frustrated guys like Martin Ferk and TJ Tynan would get with just how bruising, you know, guys like, you know, throwing Dalton Smith in the lineup to throw a curveball in there. It's like, okay, here we go. And so bringing that mentality into game one, I felt like the Eagles were kind of like, all right, let's, you know, punch him in the mouth. And Stockton's like, nope, too quick for you. Not going to happen. So, and yeah, it was amazing to me. I mean, granted, Stockton can get a little physical, but I feel like the dial was more towards, you know, method and, you know, just strategy than to physicality. And you probably noticed that too, Megan.
Yeah, they needed to inject offense into their game every area possible, and so the services of Dalton Smith were largely unnecessary. Even Sam Parranta, yeah. And Olsson is so new, he's still figuring out his game. It just felt like an obvious choice to utilize Bauers for this series more than he was, but who knows what's going on behind the scenes. He's had, you know, lingering injuries crop up. Maybe there were some things that were giving him some problems. It's tough to say. I wished I had done an exit interview with Cronin at the end of this season. It's still on the table. I haven't taking that off, but I'd love to learn about Bauer specifically.
Oh yeah. Alrighty.
All right. One thing that we did want to bring up too is, and I'll pose this both to you both before I answer, is how do you think of the season in sum for the Eagles? Is this a clear success, a clear failure, or somewhere in the gray in between? CeCe, I'll let you go first here.
Okay. I would say it's a success. I mean, you know, third year in, you know, not well, fourth year total. 2021 was a bit of an aberration in regards to being a season. But I feel like to progress all the way to the Pacific Division Finals, when as far as you made it before in a Calder Cup playoffs was just the first round and you were defeated, I would say just that in general was a success. The way they went out against Stockton, I'm sure Coach Cronin doesn't dub that a success or view that as a success. But in regards to the development of players, especially with the development of Eustace Annunen, you know, I feel like he would chalk that up as a success. A lot of the guys coming in, and Jean-Luc Foudy really showing out this postseason after kind of a pedestrian regular season, but really stepping up his game, getting a couple overtime winners and really kind of growing into that speed to where, you know, he had all this speed, but the hockey IQ hadn't quite caught up yet. I think his hockey IQ is getting better. I think him being only, you know, 20 years old and already having two seasons of AHL hockey under his belt is definitely a benefit to him. You know, and so I think long answer to a short question. Overall, I think the season was a net success for the Colorado Eagles. Megan.
I completely agree. I think to sweep the first and second round teams the way that they did is pretty historic for such a young team that's building its history as we speak. But even looking down the lineup, a lot of guys, young and old, had career years unlike anything they've ever seen in their professional time, like Jordan Gross and Kiefer Sherwood. And so I think those are guys you expect to have good years, right? They're a little older, more experienced. But even players like Jean-Luc Foudy had massive improvement from start to finish. That to see that kind of improvement on an individual level, it definitely translates to success team-wide. And I get the impression, too, that this was just slightly a different year for the Eagles. I think that they were really dialed in from coach to team and then teammate to teammate. It just felt like they were very cohesive. And so I think it is a huge accomplishment for them. And there's a lot to build on moving forward.
I agree that it's a success, but I think it's a little bit more of a tempered one. Obviously results, you know, they'd rather, you know, go down a little more swinging in the Stockton series than probably what happened. They'd rather have more, you know, losing 3-2 or 5-4 than 1-0, but I digress. I think that victory over Ontario, sweeping a very good Reign team, especially, you know, with former Eagle TJ Tynan on it, definitely helps everyone see that as a success in their eyes. I think without that Ontario season win, we may be having a different conversation if they go down there. And I think from a developmental perspective, as you know, the Avs' number one developer of Utes, they did well. I saw guys take steps forward, Eustace and Noonan in a big way, and a lot of others, but no one that I really felt like that was in the AHL for a reason for the Eagles as a developmental piece or project took, you know, the leap forward that I would have hoped to have seen. We talked about Shane Bowers and Martin Kaut as well. Like, both had good seasons, productive seasons. They made steps, but I think, you know, they need to, next season needs to be that plant the flag, I'm ready for the NHL season for them, or we may be asking questions at this time next year. But I definitely think a success, but I think I'm a little pinch lower, lower than you guys are overall. But I'm usually the negative one here. So let's quickly look ahead here, see who is at least under contract for Colorado next year and who can walk away and who can, well, not technically walk away, but offer sheeted and that kind of thing. CeCe, do you want the under contracts or the free agent guys portion of this?
I think I'll take the under contract guys. So they've got a good number of people coming in, a couple of new faces possibly coming in on entry-level deals. So we'll start with Sampo Ranta. Ben Myers has already made his NHL debut at the Avalanche later portion of this season. Oscar Olsson, like Megan mentioned earlier, Alex Bocage, Jean-Luc Foudy, Martin Kaut, Jason Megna, Ryan Wagner on the last year of his AHL deal, Wyatt Amet, Danila Zuravilov. I struggle with those Russian names. Nate Klerman, although he spent a lot of time with the Grizzlies this year, he may get a nod as a bottom pairing defenseman with the Eagles. Rob Hamilton and the two netminders under contract, Eustace Noonan and Trent Meyer. Unrestricted free agents, Sean.
Stefan Matteau, Dylan Secura, Kiefer Sherwood, Gabriel Fontaine, Dalton Smith, Keaton Middleton, Charles Edward Dastos, Andreas Englund, and Hunter Mishka. Big pile of unrestricted free agents there. So a lot of questions for who the Eagles want to bring back, who they want to resign. Restricted free agents, Shane Bowers, Cal Burke, Nicholas Henry, Mikhail Maltsev, Andreas Wingerli, who has been rumored to be floating to the Swedish Hockey League, Dennis Gilbert, Jordan Gross, Jacob McDonald, and Roland McCune. From the RFA group, I cannot imagine any of them don't get a qualifying offer. Like, I would be shocked to see any of them, you know, get left out in the cold by Colorado. So anyone stand out to you, CeCe or Megan, that may not, from the RFA list there, be, you know, someone that gets a QO?
Megan, go ahead.
Was Bowers on the?
Yep, Bowers is an RFA.
That's the only one I have a question mark about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm seeing the path to the NHL through the Colorado Avalanche becoming more difficult for him. But I mean, I don't see the harm in offering a qualifying offer. I don't know. That's the only one I have a question mark around.
Yeah, I could, like, I think that they might not see, you know, a bright future for him in the Colorado organization, but like, the dude was a number one pick, you know, only a handful of years, or not a number one, a first round pick, only a handful of years ago. So if nothing else, they'd keep him to send him, if they were going to send him somewhere else, like, you don't let that guy walk for free. So like, right. I see what you're saying about that's kind of like the question mark, but I cannot imagine Joe Sakic is going to let him just walk out the door. That's someone I could see, you know, taking a QO for a 2-year deal and then next year being traded, you know, at the draft for a, you know, package for something else. Like, in terms of UFAs though, Matteau, Secura, Sherwood, Fontaine, Dalton Smith, Middleton, Dastos, Englund, Mishka, CeCe, most likely to come back, least likely to come back in your mind?
Oh, I would say most likely to come back, I'm going to say probably Kiefer Sherwood. Least likely to come back, I'm going to go with, oh man, I'm gonna say, I mean, he didn't really play a whole lot in with the Eagles, but Desto just showed out and set records in the ECHL, both in the regular season and the postseason. So his stock is super high. I can see him signing an AHL deal elsewhere. Or maybe if Colorado decides to sign him to another AHL deal and make it a one-way this time. And maybe Miska, maybe he walks. It's tough to say. There's a lot of good names on that list, though. Megan, what are your thoughts?
I don't know who I could see walking away, because I just got the impression that a lot of people on this team would like to play here compared to other leagues, unless they're looking at career growth, because that list is kind of the veteran type player too. I don't know if they're looking to have a larger role at a different organization. I know that is Gilbert on the UFA list as well, it looks like. I know he filed for arbitration last offer, so maybe he's looking for something, a bigger role on a different team. I don't know that.
Gilbert's actually a restricted free agent, but I mean, you still got Mateau, Sherwood, okay. Sakura, and then the depth forward guys, you know, like Fontaine, Smith, and Keaton Middleton, I could see maybe moving on. You know, offensive threat, Keaton Middleton. Oh, that was a joke with Megan and I last year.
I think I actually disagree. I think Middleton is most likely to stay of anyone there. I think he's someone who's carved out a good role and is someone who, you know, when the Avs get injured at defenseman, is someone that they can point to and call up and have him be just a reliable, you know, 14, 15 minute a night defenseman. So I think, you know, if they present a reasonable offer to Keaton Middleton, I think he stays. If I had to pick one to leave, I'm going to say Dylan Sakura. Not that he didn't have a great season or really enjoy it, but I definitely think he's someone to, you know, he's getting a little up there in the years of, you know, viable hockey player left in his professional career. I mean, he's 27, so there's, you know, rightfully probably only four or five more whacks at this. So if I'm him, I might be looking for a place where I could, you know, do some get some more games that, you know, for those NHL dollars. And seeing the Colorado depth at forward, that's looking like that's going to be the most uphill battle you could possibly have, especially because his skill set is not like Keaton Middleton's, where he can be a reliable fourth liner on Colorado. I don't think that's going to be something that they think of him as, in that role, or that he thinks of himself in that role. So I could see him, you know, looking for greener pastures somewhere else to try and get a more permanent crack at an NHL roster and an NHL paycheck on a regular basis. So if I had to pick one, I think Sakura is the most likely in my mind to walk. But as we have a long history of doing, you know, we're not great at the roster moves aspect of the AHL. The rest of it, I feel like we do pretty well at. But that one, for some reason, we brick quite often.
So now that Megan's back, okay, let me throw some names out there. Dylan Sakura, Kiefer Sherwood. We'll throw offensive threat Keaton Middleton in there. And then we'll also do let's also do Hunter Miska. So out of those four, who do you see staying and who do you see going?
I see Miska staying. I see I already forgot everyone in this list, but I feel like you started with Sherwood as well.
Sherwood, Sakura, and Middleton.
Sakura I see leaving. Sherwood I see staying. Miska I see staying. And then Middleton was the other one.
Yeah.
I see Middleton staying.
That's fair.
I think he would take a team-friendly offer. I think he likes it.
He always does the NHL 94, you know, celebration after wins and everything, just with the stick in the air and everything. It's pretty neat to see.
It is funny.
If that's the only reason to keep him around, then so be it. But no,
you know, he's actually been great too with when he's paired alongside, like, he was with Wyatt Omit for a bit. Justin Barron, rest in peace. Just kidding. He just got traded. but he actually helped these prospects to develop in a way that I didn't expect for our D-Core. So I see a lot of value in Middleton.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'd forgotten about that. Feels like Barron was on this team 100 years ago, but that's just going to show how long this season was. but anyway, Megan, I personally wanted to thank you for coming on, and I know Sean appreciates it as well. Tell the people where we can find you on the social meds, as the kids say these days, and elsewhere to find your to find your written work too for DNVR.
Definitely. I'm on Twitter, is right by Wa, and you can go to thednvr.com, and if you go to the Avalanche tab, you can find me and some articles, Megan Angley, over there as well. hopefully we'll have some off-season pieces coming too. I'm definitely looking to write a little bit about some prospects and talk to the director of amateur development over with the Avalanche and get some inside scoop on prospects in the off-season as well.
Awesome. Sounds good. Sounds good. Yeah. Megan, thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate it. We hope to have you on again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys. Have a good day.
All right.
Thanks, Megan. Appreciate it. See you around.
Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, Megan Angley of the DNVR. And yes, so with that, I think we're going to take a brief respite.
Yep, we are going to take a break here. After the break, we will get to the conference final previews. We'll start in the East and then go West. If you're just here for postmortems, thank you for stopping by. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you're listening to us from so you get episodes in a timely fashion. Also, check us out on social media. Links to our social media and more can be found on our Linktree page at linktr.ee/thecalderfarmstead. We're going to run some ads, pay some bills. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. And we're back from break. CeCe, we have we're down to four teams. We've gone from, you know, 23 somehow to four. Let's preview them. Let's get to it, East to West.
Yeah, yeah, and we're in the Eastern Conference Finals. We've got the second seed coming out of the Atlantic Division, the Springfield Thunderbirds, against the third seed coming out of the North Division, the Laval Rocket. We've got a potential of seven games. We've had three-game series to start off, then five-game series at most. We're finally at the seven games. Here we go. So game one, Saturday, June 4th, 7:35 p.m. Eastern at Springfield. Game two, Sunday, June 5th. Back-to-back games, 5:05 p.m. Eastern at Springfield as well. Games 3 and 4 in Laval. Game 3 is Wednesday, June 8th at 7 p.m. Eastern. Game 4 is Friday, June 10th at 7 p.m. Eastern. Oh, and Game 5, if necessary, on Saturday, June 11th, 7 p.m. Eastern at Laval as well. We've got a 2-3-2 format, so Games 6 and 7 in Springfield, if necessary. Monday, June 13th, 7:05 p.m. Eastern for Game 6. Wednesday, June 15th, 7:05 p.m. Eastern for game number 7. So, with all that said, lots of potential games to be played. The Springfield Thunderbirds. Shawnee, how did they get here?
So, they beat Wilkes-Barre-Scranton in the division semifinals in three games, then beat the Charlotte Checkers in the division finals in three games. Their season record was 43-33 with a .625 points percentage. Their net power play and rank from the regular season was 16.6. That was 13th in the AHL in the regular season. In the playoffs, though, 37.9% net power play. That is second of 23, only because Utica only got to play a handful of games, and, well, there's some sample size in there. Net penalty kill and rank from the regular season was 81.2%. That was 26th in the AHL in the regular season. In the playoffs, though, 90.9% net penalty kill. That is fourth of the 23 playoff teams. Their playoff estimated PDO is 107.9. So riding a nice little PDO bender there. But let's talk about Springfield here. If Springfield wins this series, it will be because the defense handles the speed of Laval. At many times in the North Division Finals, Rochester looked unprepared to handle Laval's speed, and the Rocket went flying past them and made it seem like they had seven guys on the ice at times. If Springfield is going to win this series, they're going to need to come up with the answers that the Amerks didn't. That could be hard, too, as they have quite a few defensemen who are bigger, stronger, but not quite that fleet of foot. Cali Rosen can move, so can Steven Santini. The rest concern me. Especially guys like Tyler Tucker, Luke Witkowski, and Matt Kessel. But they're going to need to come up with answers for Laval's speed if they're going to win this series. If Springfield wins the series, another thing that needs to go right for them is Chucky Sidebirds and or Joel Hofer continue their strong play. I was surprised that Lindgren got called up to the Blues after Jordan Binnington was injured and chucking water bottles, and Hofer stepped in and gave them the same level of goaltending that, you know, Charlie Lindgren was, if not better. Yes, we're in the realm of judging from small sample sizes, but I still don't think anyone expected Hofer to come in and put on that kind of show. I certainly didn't. However, it's going to need to continue. Max Lagasse played admirably for Syracuse, and Laval got past them. Arundel played reasonably well given the defense in front of him, and Laval smoked them. If Springfield is going to go to the Calder Cup Finals, goaltending is going to be one of the main reasons why. And last, if Springfield wins this series, it's going to be because the McEachern Joshua Bitten line continues to shine. While it's not surprising this line has been doing well, it's surprising they're doing this well. They've outperformed the T-Birds' second line of McGing or Neal and Alexandrov and Nathan Todd, which I don't think anyone saw coming in the Charlotte series. I don't know if that continues, but this is the Eastern Conference Finals, and to win, the T-Birds are going to need to be all hands on deck, and that includes the McEachern-Joshua Bitten line, especially as Will Bitten has wheels and is able to keep up with Laval's speed. That's what I got for Springfield. CeCe, take the French part of this for me.
Oui. All right. Let's talk about how Laval got here. Previous playoff rounds, they beat Syracuse in five games. That went the distance in the best of five series in the divisional semifinals. And they beat Rochester in three games in the divisional finals. So, busting out the brooms against the Amherst. Season record, 39-33, 590 points percentage. Net power play and rank for the regular season was 16% even, good for 19th out of 31 teams in the AHL. In the playoffs, 24.1%, good for 7th of 23 teams in the postseason. Net penalty kill and rank, 85.9% in the regular season, good for 7th in the AHL. In the playoffs, 86.2%, 5th out of 23 teams, about the same. Playoffs estimated PDO, 101.7, so pretty close to 100 there. A little bit over, but yeah, not too shabby. All right, if the Laval Rocket are to win the Eastern Conference Finals, they do so by containing Sam Annis. Sam Annis has been on fire in the T-Birds playoff run, and while he got a slow start to the season, he has very much looked like the top AHL player he was in 2019-20 in Iowa since about mid-December. The Kostin, Pekka, Annis line has been great, but Annis is the one that's driving that success. If the Vol is going to win this series, containing Sam Annis is priority one. Secondly, Laval wins the series if they put a lid on the Thunderbirds' power play. This goes hand in hand with containing Sam Annis, as half of his points this postseason are power play points. It's like going back to Iowa Wild and throwing it back there all over again. Lots of power play points for Annis. Laval just held a very dangerous Amherst power play to just one conversion on 14 chances on the series. Springfield's power play poses different challenges, though. Rochester was trying to use quick puck movement to free up shooting lanes for one-timers for guys like Quinn or Paterka. Springfield doesn't really look for one-timers and instead is looking to let Sam Annis get the puck high in the zone and work downhill where he can hit McGing in the slot for a quick shot. Go across Royal Road on other side for a high-danger attempt. Usually it's Pekka there, but not always. Or he can kick it back to the point for a shot through a layered screen from Brady Lyle. Or, hell, Annis can shoot it himself. Springfield is also incredibly patient and efficient on their zone entries on the power play. They don't always have to hit the line with speed, but they will regroup and double back to gain the zone, which is different than what Rochester did. Caden Primeau continues to lock it down. That's the third and final point if the Rocket are to win this series. I've been impressed with Primeau in the playoffs thus far. How much of his run this postseason is sustainable success? That's a story for another time. However, I still expect the Laval defense to have moments of chaos in front of him and to have those breakdowns. Just like in the series against the Amherst, when those moments happen, he'll need to come up with more answers than the T-Birds goaltenders if the Laval Rocket, are to win this. So that's what the Rocket's going to have to do. They're going to have to have their victory in the series. Sean, what is going to be the X factor?
The X factor for us for this series is net front defense. In basketball analysis, you hear a lot about dominating the paint, winning battles around the baskets, getting rebounds, and overpowering the defense from the low post. This is not a basketball podcast or a farming podcast, but that analysis kind of shifts into this series a little bit here. Springfield seems to execute the hockey version of that against Charlotte. They dominated the net front. They made sure Joey DeCourt didn't have a lot of clean looks at shots. They got an ungodly number of goals from tip-ins that DeCourt never had a chance at. Springfield's forward group is once again going to have a size and strength advantage over their opponent's defensive core and will very likely look to play that same power game down low and, in basketball terms, dominate the paint. Laval has had struggles defending that as well. Brett Murray in the last series certainly found some success. And did the Amherst ever miss Michael Mersch in that series? Laval is also looking to attack that area in the net front, but they do so in a very different way. Laval is looking to thread passes into that high-danger net front area and score that way. If T-Birds fans remember how Zach Dalpe scored in Game 2 of that series, just finding soft ice at the net front and ripping a one-timer off a nice pass, that's what Laval is looking to do off the cycle. But they're also looking to sauce passes into the slot and across Railroad on rush chances as well. Basically, both teams are looking to do damage from those high danger areas right at the top of the crease, but they do so in vastly different ways. Springfield with screens, tips, and winning battles at the net front with their power forwards. Laval with playmaking, setting up backdoor tap-ins. Either way, net front defense is going to play a pivotal role in this series, even though it's going to look different for both sides. But which team does it best is very likely to win.
Okay, it is time for the last portion of this Eastern Conference final segment. Of course, it's time for the picks. And as always, I shall go first. Man, I know that Springfield fans are going to argue against this because they're undefeated in the postseason, but I feel like Laval has a lot of momentum that they continue to build upon in this playoffs. And so with that in mind, I say this is going to be a close series that goes the distance. Six or seven games, I don't think is going to be a surprise to me. But in the end, it's the Rocket blasting off again.
Getting Cali Rosen back is a nice boost for Springfield, but I think Laval has too much going for it at the moment. They're a faster team top to bottom, and I believe more in the body of work that Caden Primo has presented in the playoffs than Lindgren and Hofer. I think that is a more sustainable level of success for goaltending as a whole on Laval's side. I agree that I think this series is not going to be over quickly. I also think it's a different caliber of team. The Atlantic was, I think, by far the weakest division this year. They only had two teams with winning records in the Atlantic division, Springfield and Charlotte. Providence was at 500. Everyone else lost more games, whether in overtime or in the shootout, than they won. And that's not true of any of the other divisions. I've said the whole time, I thought the North, whoever won the North, was going to walk to the Eastern Conference Finals. I maybe don't think it's going to be a walk necessarily. I think Springfield is going to give Laval a very good test here, but I still think this is Laval's series. That's not to say Springfield can't win or won't win, but you know, standing here on the precipice of these games getting started, I think Laval is favored for a reason. And that's how the model sees it as well. The model has Laval as a 54.8% favorite in the series. But the games are going to be close, and I think this one goes six or seven.
Yep, we seem to be in the same boat there.
Yep. So we are going to take a break. After the break, we will head to the other half of the conference finals here in Stockton and Chicago. If you're just here to listen to Springfield and Laval, thank you for stopping by. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you're listening to us from so you get episodes in a timely fashion. Also, check us out on social media. Links to all of that and more can be found in our Linktree page at linktr.ee/TheCalder Farmstead. We're going to run some ads, pay some bills. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Okay, we have returned from break, and we have one more conference final to discuss. And of course, that's going to be the Stockton Heat coming out of the Pacific Division against the Chicago Wolves. Both of these teams winning their respective divisions. And yes, good little visual there from Shawnee. And both of them, you know, right up to the end, going for that regular season crown as well. So Sean, let's preview it. Let's see where these games are going to be held. And if it goes all seven, let's see what it holds for us.
So number one Stockton against number one Chicago, game number one, Friday, June 3rd, not Saturday, Friday, June 3rd, 7 p.m. Central Time at Chicago. Game two, Monday, June 6th, 7 p.m. Central Time at Chicago. Game number three, the series flips to Stockton Wednesday, June 8th at 6:30 Pacific Standard Time. Or Pacific's, yes, yeah, Standard Time. That sounds correct. At Stockton. Game number four, Friday, June 10th, 7 p.m. Pacific in Stockton. Game number five, if necessary, which probably will be, Saturday, June 11th, 6 p.m. In Stockton. Game six, Tuesday, June 14th, if necessary, 7 p.m. in Chicago. And if necessary, game seven, Wednesday, June 15th, 7 p.m. in Chicago. CeCe, start me off with Stockton here. How did they get here?
Well, Stockton, of course, the only team in the Pacific with a first-round bye. But in the second round, they beat Bakersfield in three games in the divisional semifinals, and they beat Colorado in four games in the divisional finals. And if you listen to our post-mortem against Colorado, we kind of dived into that a little deeper. So go back and listen to that if you missed it. Season record for Stockton, 45-23, 7-1 three-points percentage. Net power play and ranking on the regular season, 17.9%, good for seventh in the AHL. In the playoffs, a little bit of a dip, 16.7%, 12th out of 23 teams in the Calder Cup playoffs. Net penalty kill and rank, regular season, they were first in the AHL, 91.8%. In the playoffs, a little bit of a dip, 85% even, 7th out of 23 teams, still not too shabby. Playoffs estimated PDO clocking in at 104.6. Now, if the Stockton Heat win, first, it's going to be because the special teams make noise. The Heat's power play was effective in the regular season, but was never one you thought of as a world beater. They've looked a bit worse in the playoffs and had a lot of opportune power plays in the series against Colorado that they just couldn't really get anything going with them. That's not going to hold up against Chicago if they want to win. On the other side of the coin, their PK was lights out during the regular season, and while Bakersfield did find some success against it, Colorado did not. That Stockton power kill is going to need to bring its A game, though, as Chicago's power play is loaded and is capable of tilting a series in their favor. If Stockton wins, their special teams found a higher gear and helped push them over the finish line. Number two, and this is a big bullet point here, Adam Ruzicka looks like one of the best players in the AHL. Before he got called up to Calgary, he had 16 points in 14 games and looked poised to light the American Hockey League on fire, no pun intended. Calgary called him up around Thanksgiving, and he stayed in Calgary for most of the remainder of the season, only playing three more games for Stockton during that period of time. Despite miserable ice time in Calgary, Ruzicka put up respectable numbers. However, his last game before game number four in Colorado was an entire month prior. And in that Colorado game, he looked fine, but not the top AHL forward that he rightfully is. I imagine it takes a game or two for him to shake off that month-long rink rust and get back to that form. It may take a little more, or it may take less, who knows. But Ruzicka is probably the most talented skater in the series. And if Stockton wins, it's because Adam Ruzicka found that form and put on a show. That's all I have for Stockton. Sean, the other side of things, the Chicago Wolves, tell me, how did they get here?
Well, they got here by beating Rockford in three games in the divisional semifinals. They beat Milwaukee in four games in the divisional finals. Chicago's season record, best in the AHL, 50-26 for a 7.24 points percentage. Their net power play and rank from the regular season was 17.1%. That was 11th in the AHL. In the playoffs, though, 25%. That is still only good for fifth out of 23 playoff teams because, well, we've had some wild power plays to speak of in the AHL playoffs. Net penalty kill and rank, 87.9% in the regular season. That was third in the AHL. In the playoffs, 77.4% net penalty kill, 17th out of 23. Not great, Bob. Their playoff estimated PDO, a piping hot PDO bender for the Chicago Wolves, 107.6. That's definitely sustainable. If Chicago wins this series, it's because depth scoring shone through. I'm basically just expecting at this point that Stockton somehow snuffs the Podorowski and Drury lines. And that's not a knock on Podorowski or Drury's lines or Stefan Nason or any of those guys by any means. It's just what Stockton's done in the playoffs. Bakersfield had their two leading scorers in Griffith and Marody combined for one primary point in the divisional semifinal series. They had 103 combined in the regular season, otherwise known as 1.7 per game, and in three games, they managed to squeak out one. Colorado had Sakura and Sherwood combined for three primary points in their four games against Stockton. They combined for 122 in the regular season, otherwise known as 2.1 primary points per game between the two of them combined in the regular season, and they combined for three in four games. Stockton's game plan very much looks like something out of something that Bill Belichick and the New England Patriots are famous for. Oh, you have something that drives your offense and wins you games? Well, let's see how you do when I pour all of my energy into taking that away from you and forcing you to beat us with something else. In this series, that means guys like Stelio Mateos, Vasily Ponomarev, and Jameson Rees are going to need to find the score sheet in order for Chicago to win this series, because I'm just spotting that Stockton is going to find ways to shut down the Podorowski and Drury lines. If Chicago Wolves win this series, it'll be because they get busy finding a way through the neutral zone or get busy recovering dump-ins. The other impressive aspect of Stockton's playoff run has been their ability to just dominate the neutral zone. They've grounded teams and forced them to play dump and chase or turn the puck over through the neutral zone. Chicago's staff is, in my opinion, is the best coaching staff the Heat will face in this postseason, period. Stockton won our best coaching staff award. Chicago came in fourth on our ballot by the slimmest of margins. This was, splitting hairs for us to be able to pull that out. But if Chicago wins, one of the biggest reasons is that Ryan Warsawski and company made a game plan that can beat Stockton's forecheck and ability to turn dump-ins into controlled zone exits. And Chicago executed that game plan four times over 60-plus minutes. That's how Chicago is going to win this series, because Stockton has made teams look dumb in the neutral zone, and they've gotten dump-ins back, and they've sent the puck the other way. Chicago is going to need to come up with answers for that. Our X factor for this series is going to be the Chicago Wolves goaltending. Alex Lyon has been very good for Chicago so far in this playoffs. However, I don't think he's had a particularly rough ride to this point. Chicago is second in shot suppression in the Calder Cup playoffs, and I think Stockton gives them a much more challenging test than either Rockford or Milwaukee did by a wide margin. Pyotr Kochetkov also just got sent back, so if Lyon stumbles, we could see him take over the starter's crease. However, Kochetkov has 22 whole games of North American professional hockey experience under his belt. And yes, he looked very good in the 15 games he played in the AHL this season, and less good in the NHL, but, you know, still, that's credit where it's due. 22 games, though, is nowhere near a big enough sample to draw any kind of firm conclusions about who he is as a goaltender right now in time. I think the future is bright for him, but this isn't about the future. This is about right stinking now. Regardless of who takes over the crease for the Wolves, they're going to be tested in a big way, and the balance of this series is likely going to be determined by how well they do on that test. It's like the GRE for Chicago goaltenders. You can prepare all you want, but your ability is going to be tested in ways that are unfair, and your future depends on them.
Nice analogy to finish up there. Yeah. All right, time for picks, and I will go first. Okay. I tell you, Stockton didn't just beat Colorado in four games last series, but they had three shutouts against a solid offensive team in the Eagles. Head coach Mitch Love has been crowned the A.R. Pierre Memorial Award, or crowned with that award, for AHL Coach of the Year. He now has my call for coronation as the king of strategic compensation. The man just adjusted his roster well, and yeah, they just made Colorado look pedestrian in three out of those four games. Heat in five.
Five.
Heat in five. Wow.
I say the battle of Alberta here makes all the difference. If Calgary is still playing in the playoffs, I think I call this series for Chicago a reasonably close series, but I think Chicago triumphs here. But Stockton getting reinforcements back from Calgary getting bounced, they're getting a potential top 10 forward in the league in Ruzicka, a number one defenseman in Connor Mackey, and a steady second pair defenseman in Vala Mackey. That clearly tips the scales here in their favor. I'm going Stockton, but I think this one probably goes six games plus. But I it's hard to like, yes, Chicago has done what it's supposed to do. It's beaten the crap out of teams that, you know, it was well head and shoulders above. But it's hard not to see what Stockton did to a team that had legitimate Calder Cup aspirations in Colorado and just ground them. I have to go Stockton here. I'm taking Stockton at 7. The model is on my side too. Model has Stockton as a 52.1% favorite in the series. Before reinforcements for Calgary got here, I want to say Chicago was a 53 or 54% favorite.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, those reinforcements matter. And I think that's the difference.
Okay. Well, we're recording this the evening, Thursday evening, June 2nd. So now we wait for game one of both the Eastern Conference and the Western Conference finals to come up on Friday when you're hopefully enjoying this episode. But alas, we are at the end, and that is it for the show. So thank you for watching and or listening. The Calder Farmstead is part of the Full Press Radio Network. You can listen to this and several other great hockey, sports, and pro wrestling programs at fullpresscoverage.com. You can just go click on the podcast drop-down menu in the top right portion of the website. That's a big old list populating there. And enjoy. And as always, thank you for tuning in with us when there's so many great choices on Full Press Coverage and so many great hockey podcasts out there.
And if you guys are enjoying the Calder Farmstead, please make sure you subscribe so you get episodes in a timely fashion. Also, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon, please rate and review the podcast. Or if you're watching on YouTube, click all the buttons, like the video, subscribe, comment what you thought of the episode. Doing these things helps other people find the show, and your reviews help us improve the show. You can also follow the show on social media, at Calder Farmstead on Twitter, and at The Calder Farmstead on Instagram and Facebook. We have a pretty good time there. We post some memes. We interact with you guys, and we have a pretty decent time doing so. Links to all of that and more can be found on our Linktree page at linktr.ee/TheCalderFarmstead. If you cannot spell that, look around. It's probably here, maybe over here somewhere. Anyway, big thanks to Adrian Drake, who made our theme music. You can find him on social media at AD_dysfunction. That's AD_DYSFUNCTION. So we can make music for you too. Cece, where can the people find you?
Well, my name is Cece Hockley. You can find me representing Full Press Hockey on Twitter at FPC_AHL. Do my best to tweet out all the latest AHL news from that account. You can also find me at my personal Twitter account at Cece Hawk. That's SeeSeeHawk. Mainly hockey tweets, but you know, pro wrestling, music, films, pop culture, my Wordle scores. Hopefully if it keeps me interested, it's not going to be bullshit for you. You can check out my writing on the Full Press Coverage Network at fullpresshockey.com. I'm working on an article of a hypothetical divisional realignment with Stockton moving back up to Calgary. So still kind of working out the kinks on that one. Stay tuned. Hope to get that published soon. Enough about me. Shawnee, where can the people find you?
I'm Sean O'Brien. You can find me on Twitter at SeanO'Brien81. That's SeanOBrien81. I'm also on Instagram at SeanO'Brien_81. There is a different SeanO'Brien81 on Instagram. I do not know him, but I'm assuming he's a long distant cousin or whatever. You can find my stats work on my Tableau page at bit.ly/datadumpandchase, all lowercase, all one word. Those will not be updated for the next 7 days until the 11th. Because I will be on vacation. Sorry about you. But that is where you can find me. But CC, this is the end. Please take us home.
That will do it for episode number 104. 10-4, good buddy. For Sean O'Brien, I'm CC Hockley. We'll catch you on the flip side. And until then, keep your stick on the ice.